From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available on iTunes.
I'm Sharon Gamble. Welcome to The Art of the Matter. On this week's program, the Broad Ripple Art Fair, Onyx Fest, and a Gilded Age train car that feels like a rolling mansion. And don't forget, we'll have that arts calendar we call What'll We Do? All that and much more right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Later today, the Virginia Avenue Folk Fest has something for nearly every musical taste. But first, if it's summer in Indy, it's time for outdoor art fairs. If you've lived in central Indiana for a while, you know that we bookend the summer with the Broad Ripple Art Fair and the Penrod Arts Fair. I asked the Indianapolis Art Center's Patrick Flaherty to tell us about the Broad Ripple Art Fair on the Art Center's campus coming up May 20th and 21st. So, Patrick, you've been with the Indianapolis Art Center for a long time and not always in the top position. So you used to get to wrestle the Broad Ripple Art Fair to the ground in a little bit different way than you do now.
Yeah, I've worked at the Art Center since 2003, right when I got out of grad school, and I've worn many, many different hats. But I did actually run the Broad Ripple Art Fair, which is now the One America Broad Ripple Art Fair, but I actually directed that for 4 years before taking this position. And before that, I was responsible for the artist committee, because we do bring in hundreds of artists from across the country. So I've seen many facets of the fair, and now just get to kind of help and support however I can.
What is the hardest thing about putting on an event like this?
You know, there's just so many moving parts and moving pieces. And then, you know, as you have staff that come and go, it's just keeping the making sure everything continues on and just keeping all the moving pieces up. That is clearly the job of the director of the fair to organize that. But you're working with volunteers, you're working with staff, you're working with outside sponsors and marketing folks. And so there's just many, many moving parts. So you just have to kind of keep it all organized and make sure you know what's going on. And so it's just a big organizational task.
I know you weren't there at its founding, but can you tell me a little bit about what is the mission of the fair?
Well, the One America Broad Ripple Art Fair is the largest fundraiser for the Indianapolis Art Center. So without this event, we could not bring the art education and free exhibitions and outreach programs that we provide to Indianapolis. This simply is critical to the mission of the Indianapolis Art Center. So, but the flip side of that, it also dovetails directly with the mission to support artists, in that we will have over 220 professional artists at the fair selling their wares. So whereas the gate admissions benefit the art fair, all of the money that the artists make that weekend stays with them. So we look at it as, you know, 220 micro economies of these artists that are there, as well as incredible food. And there's, you know, Sun King Beer will be there, and there's good vendors, the Broad Ripple Brew Pub and all that. So, you know, but the actual mission of it, it is a fundraiser. You know,
sure.
This allows the Art Center to carry on with our programs.
And the artists are from a pretty broad geographic spectrum, right?
We've had them come from as far as South America in the past. I don't know if we've had anyone cross the pond, but I wouldn't say that it has never happened. But largely regional, but we do have a national reach, and we are a nationally ranked fair. There are a couple trade groups, if you will, out there, and the art fair, the Broad Ripple Art Fair, consistently ranks well with those in terms of the way the sales that we generate for artists. So we have a good reputation, but you will meet, if you've been to the fair before, you'll certainly see people that have been there. But every year we have a new set of jurors. Every year we have fresh eyes on the fair. So it's never a guarantee
that
the same person will come back. And we honor our jurors' scores. So, you know, if it's somebody that's been there for a few years and for one reason or another they don't score well, we honor the scores. But it is a complicated process, because not everyone that's invited accepts, because art fairs are a very tough industry. So oftentimes artists will apply to 3 or 4 shows a weekend. And
wow.
So sometimes they'll take the one that's an hour away instead of 10 hours away. You know, so it is a moving target. But the artists come from across the country. And to that point, you will meet the artist that made the work. And that's really something we enforce quite strictly, because this isn't a chain store. This isn't going to get a painting that was made in a factory somewhere. This is, you get to meet the artist that made the work. And so you do get to have a rapport with them. And that's – where else can you do that?
Yeah.
I mean, First Friday, sure. You know, you can meet them locally in town. But to have access to 220 artists for a weekend for $15 and you can come both days, I think is a pretty awesome opportunity.
And I know because I talked to friends who've had – similar experiences. I met a jeweler, bought some earrings from her. It's been 8 or 10 years ago. Loved her work, started following her on social media and then going to other art fairs in drivable distance that she does. So there really is the chance to get to know the source of the art and to be a part of the quality of life for that artist.
Yeah, there's a story with every piece that's made at the art fair, and you can meet those individuals. And we've had patrons that actually host artists at their house. They develop these long relationships with them. And so it is really I can't stress enough how cool it is to get to shake the hand and hear the story of the person that you're taking on those earrings or the ceramic vessel or a painting. And to that point, too, there, if you've never been to the One America Bridal Art Fair, there is something truly for everyone and for all price points. You can take away original art, you know, for $20 or $30 for a really fine handcrafted mug or a nice set of earrings, or you can get a custom crafted cut diamond ring. You know, there's things that are collector items that are quite expensive, but it is something where even my children, I have an 11 and 8-year-old daughter. Last year, they had a budget of $25, and they went and they spent that on art. But they're buying art, and it's starting that tradition with the next generation. So truly, all kinds of varieties, whether it's functional or just fine art. You know, and then there's also hands-on activities and opportunities for you to make your own art as well. The inside of the Nepos Art Center is open. There'll be demos in the glass studio. So we have some of the best glass blowers in the country, and they work at the art center. And so they'll be showing off their stuff. There'll be forging demonstrations. There'll be opportunity to participate in a giant Jackson Pollock-esque painting experience.
That's fun.
Yeah, so come fling some paint around.
Where that'll be on display?
It'll be inside the art center, but that you will actually be able to create it. So there will be staff there, and you and or, you know, we usually find that people would come for their kids, but then the adults actually end up having just as much, if not more fun. But that'll be in one of the studios, and there'll be an opportunity for you to participate and get an experience of what he may have experienced. And then another really zany thing that's new this year, they're always coming, the programmers at the Art Center are so creative, and we're going to have Clay Olympics.
Yeah, what is that? I read that and I'm like, that's crazy cool. What is that?
Yeah, I'm kind of excited to check it out myself, but these are, you know, the Olympics are the top athletes performing these incredible feats of athleticism, and we have some incredible ceramic faculty, and they are going to be going head to head with who can throw the fastest pot, who can build the tallest pot, and it's just riffing off. It's a fun idea. You know, it is meant to be humorous, but I think it's also will give the public as they're coming through, the patrons of the fair, an opportunity to see just how much skill goes into this, but that we also can have fun while we're doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really clever of you to show off the art center. I mean, you're luring thousands of people there to look at art that's been adjudicated from all over the place, but don't miss the chance to go inside and see the studios and see these demonstrations and cheer on your favorite clay Olympian.
Yeah, well, and that's something that when I took over the fair several years ago, it was a very early objective I had, which was to turn the inside of the building into something like an open house. And I think that opening up and showing off what we do. I mean, there's kids' activities throughout the fair. There are opportunities to hear and learn about the Art Center throughout the fair. But really, we have an incredible Michael Graves building, one of two in his hometown. And it's just a beautiful place to check out. But we have these 11 university-quality studios that anyone from the public can sign up and take classes in year-round. And it's just, why would we hide that during a time where we're bringing tens of thousands of people to our grounds?
The Indianapolis Art Center's Patrick Flaherty. The Broad Ripple Art Fair is May 20th and 21st and features more than 225 visual artists plus music, food, libations, and tours and demonstrations of the Art Center. Your ticket gets you in both days, and by the way, some PBS Kids characters will be there too. Get the skinny at indplusartcenter.org. That's indplusartcenter.org. It started life as Heartland Actors Repertory Theater, but for the past 8 years, its primary focus has been creating free summer Shakespeare in White River State Park. And so now the company formerly known as Heart has taken on a new name, Indianapolis Shakespeare Company. Producing Artistic Director Diane Timmerman and the director of this summer's production of As You Like It, company member Ryan Artsberger, join Indianapolis Business Journal arts and entertainment editor Lou Harry to discuss the newly rechristened company.
So what we once knew as Heartland Actors Repertory Theater is now becoming Indianapolis Shakespeare Company. Tell us a little bit about what the thinking was behind that change, why that decision.
So Heartland Actors Repertory Theater has been in existence since 2006. It began with a production of Death and the Maiden. They began by doing contemporary work. And over the years, we started to do the Shakespeare in White River State Park. And that production really took hold and galvanized us as a company. And so over the past years, we've had some identity problems. People don't know who Heartland Actors Repertory Theater is. Sometimes people get us confused with a film festival. And so we had a strategic planning process last year funded by Lilly Endowment. And that was one of the main priorities that came out of that. We talked to a lot of different people around the city and reflected ourselves as well and decided that a name change that really said what we did was going to be crucial to setting the stage for the coming decades.
And does that name change indicate that Shakespeare, et cetera, will be the primary or exclusive focus of the company over the next few years?
It will be the exclusive focus in the next couple of years. But like all great Shakespeare festivals, contemporary work is not excluded necessarily. For the moment, for the next couple of years, it will be solely Shakespeare. But we are very open to expanding to doing other things again.
Okay. And for those who haven't been to White River State Park to any of the Shakespeare productions, tell us a little bit about the magnitude of it. This is fully professional theater, for one thing. It's a weekend of performances every summer. What kind of crowds are you attracting?
So we have a beautiful mix of every kind of human being in Indianapolis you can think of. So we have people who are skateboarding by who stop and just join us. We have families who've come to depend on our production because it is free. We have what I call the arts connoisseurs of Indianapolis are a big chunk of our audience. And we have anywhere from 9 to 13% of our audience has never seen live theater before. And that's a really big number. So we love that we serve those people too. And we serve them an incredible product because all of our actors, designers, technicians, directors are always of the highest caliber.
Tell a little bit in directing a show as you're doing with As You Like It this summer. You have to take into account things you wouldn't necessarily take into account if you're staging in a traditional theater, things like what time the sun's going down and things like that.
Well, that has been a point that we have to deal with. And I am trying to think of my sort of overall principle is embrace the space, meaning that some of the early staging I'm going to hope to set off to the left so that people aren't looking into the sun as it sets. But yeah, and the other main thing is the finding the balance for the actors between true depth of believing your situation and expanding your expressiveness to accommodate a space that size.
Great. And why As You Like It now?
Part of the reason I'm directing is because we sort of lost our go-to director a couple of years ago and then a couple of company members threw our names in the hat for possible direction. And I got tapped for this summer. And I chose As You Like It at the time because I don't want to direct something that I haven't been in yet, chiefly because I'm trying to get through the canon on my acting resume. but also, you know, the depth of knowledge that you have about a play when you're in three different runs of it can get pretty profound. And then as it turns out, it became a little more politically relevant in that a tyrant banishes people for disagreeing with him, banishes people for communicating, banishes people for being journalists, banishes people for being artists. So parallels can be seen by some people.
But it is a very forgiving play, ultimately.
Ultimately, that disappears, and it becomes a play. It becomes a play about love is real, and human connection is important, and human expression is valid and meaningful and necessary.
Contributor Lou Harry with Diane Timmerman and Ryan Artsberger. Indianapolis Shakespeare Company's As You Like It will be performed free of charge in White River State Park July 21st through the 23rd. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Later this hour, Onyx Fest comes back to the Indie Fringe building. But first, Eat Drink Indie's Jolene Ketzenberger talks with Matthew Feltrup of the Puttishoo Foundation.
The Puttishoo Foundation, as the name might suggest, grew out of Puttishoo Incorporated, the restaurants here in Indianapolis. Cafe Puttishoo, Napoli's Public Greens, Petite Shoe, and Bar 114 and Crispy Bird soon to come. So
it was a desire to give back to the community?
Absolutely. There was a desire to give back to the community, but also a desire to connect with the mission of the company itself. And Puttishoo has made a name for itself with quality food, quality service, and being radically better and different than other restaurants in town. So the vision was, let's make something that is relatable to the company, but most importantly, let's make something that's impactful in the city.
So you're setting out to address a particular problem. Talk a little bit about the mission.
Yeah, so Indianapolis is really unique, and people who are familiar with the way that Indianapolis is laid out will know that Indianapolis is ranked as the worst food access city in the United States, which is deplorable. We're sitting in the middle of the breadbasket of America, and we have neighborhoods that don't have access to fresh foods. When you couple that with some really high poverty areas in the city and the fact that kids don't know sometimes where their dinner is coming from, there's a real hunger crisis in the city. There's a nutrition crisis. And so we're addressing that issue by serving wholesome meals to kids that are prepared in the Puttishoo kitchens. And we use the same high-quality ingredients that you would be familiar with in any of the Puttishoo restaurants. We deliver them to kids and serve it to them because kids deserve to have that kind of empowered meal.
Now, how did that start? So kind of the background and when and how? I mean, tackling childhood hunger, that's a very big problem.
It's a huge problem. I think the statistics that really show that in Indianapolis are the obesity and diabetes among youth, which is pretty staggering when you compare it to the rest of the country. Martha Hoover had the vision 4 years ago to start the Puttishoo Foundation to address poverty, homelessness, and hunger in the city. So we partner with 8 different schools here in Indianapolis, and we have literally an army of 125 volunteers, and we're always looking for new volunteers. But these volunteers really help us do the work of the foundation. Those schools that we partner with run after-school activities. These are scouts, these are rocket clubs, these are just enrichment programs, tutoring. Every student who's there after school in those 8 schools, we feed them a meal. So we work with them to figure out how many kids are going to be there each day, and we prepare the meals and then deliver them to the schools, and then the volunteers help us serve the kids a plate. And it's really important for us to give a kid a plate of food, because just the reality of kind of scale production for kids' meals just in general, this might be the only meal that they get that's on a plate, that's not wrapped in cellophane, that doesn't have a wrapper around it. So it's important for us to kind of give them that experience at the table. And so volunteers help us make that happen. And then at the same time, maybe before or after the meal, we will work with some of the kids once a week on some of those education topics that we talk about. And so we have volunteers and educators that help us do that.
Now, I think people are probably interested in knowing what kind of food are you making for the kids after school. So this isn't kids' meal kind of food, is it?
Well, it's not kids' meal kind of food, but it is a kid-friendly menu that we're making. So we include four different elements in the meal. There's a whole grain. There is a serving of vegetable, a serving of fruit, and then there's a high-quality protein that we put in there. So the meals, like I said, use the same ingredients that you would get at a pot of choux restaurant, but not necessarily the same menu. So we have barbecue chicken wraps that we serve kids, Italian meatball slider that we serve with bread that our baker in-house makes for us. So really kind of kid-friendly items, but we know that they're nutrient-packed.
And high quality, coming out of the pot of choux kitchens, right?
Without a doubt.
You can hear Jolene Ketzenberger's Eat, Drink, Indy Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2 The Point. The 6th annual Onyx Fest takes to the two stages of the India Fringe Theater next week. The juried festival celebrates the work of four African-American playwrights from across the country. WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer talked with one of the playwrights who's bringing a new version of the same play she presented at the very first Onyx Fest. What's that about? Tell us.
Well, Sharon, Nicole Kearney is a nationally acclaimed playwright. She lives right here in Indianapolis, though, and she debuted her musical comedy Wedding Bells at Diva Fest 6 years ago, and then she brought it to the first Onyx Fest in 2011. Now, this year, she has added some new twists and turns to that story, and it will be one of the four plays to be presented at Onyx Fest.
We have a balance this year of social, political, and family, and then, like, mine is just fun. You know, it's just a fun musical, like, but it's got a little depth to it, but it's a lot of fun. So I think that's kind of the balance we want to keep, because I think all theater should really provoke people to think.
Well, and yours, Wedding Bells,
yeah,
started as a Diva Fest play.
Yes.
B-E-L-L-E-S.
Right. And
now
we changed
B-E-L-L-S.
It. Right. And so we kind of moved to encompass the women were the focus, and now it's the brides and the grooms, and everyone is the focus. So we kind of just switched the name change and reworked it. We've been in Chicago with it. So, yeah, it's had a really interesting journey. It was my postgraduate school project, and literally I entered it into Diva Fest, and I was still working on it. And so it went from December that I started writing it to on stage in March, which is like unheard of in musical theater. And then we did it again in August. Then we went to Chicago and refined it. So this is a newer version that has not been seen yet.
And
so
how
I'm
did
excited.
You do that? How do you craft your baby and make it even more appealing?
So a lot of people helped. It wasn't just me. I had a dramaturg. So the interesting thing is our team was all across the country. So we got a Dramatists Guild of America grant. So our dramaturg lived in West Virginia. Our composer was in Atlanta. And the theater was in Chicago. And then I live here. So we all flew in to Chicago and worked. The hardest I've ever worked ever over a weekend. Like, I respect nurses who do like 12-hour shifts, because we did a 12-hour rehearsal. We changed the play. We printed out new sheets and new copies. And then we did a performance that night. And then we took the feedback from the audience and reworked it again and did another performance. So I just sat and listened and took notes and typed. But the actors, I mean, they sang and they work with the composer. And he had to change music on the spot and print out, you know, we had to print out new music. So I was like, kudos to them, because I was just like, so you may change those words, they don't work? Great. I'm just like, okay, on my computer, print. But it was masterful. It was just the beauty of it. I had never been in such, I guess, a complex structure and seeing. I know it takes a lot of people, but to see it work through, it was just fabulous. And we didn't even have a choreographer. So we still haven't added that piece in for this show, but that is that would be the next phase.
And what did you learn from that experience too? I mean, it's your play, and you started it, but then it's grown and changed. It must have been a real learning experience for you, recrafting it.
You have to learn to let go. So like the songs that I love, because I wrote the story and all the lyrics. So all these songs that I love, you have to be able to just say, yeah, it doesn't serve the story anymore, and let them go. And it's like really hard, because you're like, but I love that song and we should do that. And they're like, no, it doesn't work. And so it's a huge compromise. And people are nice. They're like, so do you think that will work? And I'm like, yeah. And they were like, no, the arc just doesn't go up and doesn't really give the meaning. And so we condensed a couple songs, added a new one that we had to write on the spot. So I learned that energy, like, hey, you have 10 minutes to write a new song. And I was like, I've never done that. They're like, well, you have to do it. 10 minutes, you have to get the song, get the melody, give it to the composer so he can teach the music. So that is a huge challenge, but a lot of fun. A lot of fun.
Are you going to continue with the story to change it again and bring it around in another form? Or are you working on something different?
Something different. I'm pretty much happy with where The Wedding Bells is. This summer, I'm going to do a musical called In Between, which is a middle school musical. So it's something I've been working on off and on for 5 or 6 years, and my composers live in Chicago. So we finally got it together, and we've had everything that could happen has happened to the show. My composers are brother-in-laws. So my one composer lost his wife, which was the sister, the other one. One travels around the country, he's in a band, and they got stranded somewhere, and then broken thumbs have happened. You name it, it has happened to our show. And so we finally just got, like, I got the last sheet music 2 weeks ago. And so we're like, okay. So that show will be young people. And I'll kind of continue. My next several shows will be all musicals.
You just live your life, and the shows just create themselves.
I know.
Don't they?
And that's what I tell people. Oh, my gosh. It's like, what happens? And all my shows, like this Wedding Bells is a combination of many people I know's wedding stories. And so it actually, you know, life imitates art, or art imitates life. I actually got married. Now I'm divorced, but I got married at the Indie French Theater. And my husband-to-be at the time, his ex-wife actually showed up, unbeknownst to us, because the family did a great job of keeping her at bay. But that is the underlying story in The Wedding Bells. The ex-husband shows up. And so when we were finally told, you know, after the day was over and, you know, the festivities, we laughed. And they were like, why is it funny? And I was like, so I wrote this play. And yeah, it's just like, people are like, you're kidding me. I was like, I wrote this like years before I met him. But here it is. So I use a little bit of everybody's story that I know in this. And so I know a lot of my friends will see themselves reflected in the story. Hopefully, they'll be okay with it.
I have a feeling, Sharon, that her friends are going to know who they are in the play. but like Nicole said, they've been so supportive of her throughout the years that I don't think they're going to mind. And I think it's wonderful that she's been able to take a play that was so successful and kind of update it and continue it on. And I asked her, I said, so is there going to be another incarnation of this with the story? She said, I don't know.
Stay tuned.
Yeah. But Onyx Fest starts, obviously, May the 12th and runs through the 21st. So IndieFringe.org to see information on show times for her story, her play, and the other three shows as well.
Fantastic. Well, you know, we're kind of shifting gears, getting into summer festivals and all sorts of great things, both indoors and outdoors, and we have a few of them on our calendar, we call.
What do we do?
What do you have?
Well, I've got an indoor-outdoor one also coming up on Friday, May the 12th, one night only, from 6 to 9 p.m. It's the River West Art Walk, and this is the area of town just west of IUPUI on Michigan Street. And what this is that all the different artists and people in that area are coming together, and they're going to have art out on the street and music on the street and inside at Indie Convergence. And they tried to do this one time last year, and the weather was terrible. But they're part of that Great Places 2020 funding that they're getting from the city. So the whole community over there has really come together, and it's a great way to see an interesting side of Indianapolis, see the progress that they're making, and the Super Tortas there too. The Mexican cuisine over on that side of town is fantastic, so you're going to get to eat well as enjoy some art and music.
Well, we have so many more calendar items for you, but we're out of time. But don't forget, you can always learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide, or join us again next week for our calendar.
What'll we do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and in just a bit, a rolling Victorian mansion, it's on the market. But first, the third annual Virginia Avenue Folk Festival is coming up on Saturday, May 13th throughout Fountain Square. The day-long festival features more than 100 acts on 13 stages, and amazingly, it's free. Festival organizers Patrick Birch and Mike Angel came to the WFYI studios to talk about the event with the Art of the Matter contributor, Mark Allen.
So I go on the website, and I'm looking for ticket prices, and I'm thinking, where do these guys put the ticket prices for this festival? And then I found the VIP part of it, and I saw that tickets were free otherwise, and this struck me as wonderful and bizarre. So tell me about that. How did that happen, and why do you do it that way?
This will be the third year of our festival, and we've been free from day one. A big part of that is just wanting to encourage people that may not have an opportunity to go to music festivals to get an opportunity to kind of experience that and be a way to promote our neighborhood as well in a lot of different ways. That was kind of the initial thinking on that. Just trying to garner support from businesses to help us to do that. That's always a bit of a challenge, but that's one of the great things about our festival, I think.
Yeah. Well, it makes me want to talk a lot about the business, but I think, you know, this being the art of the matter, we should talk about art. So let's talk about the music. Mm-hmm. You know, who's playing and what do you like and what do you recommend?
We have 100 different performances this year, just like last year, and most of it's regional, a lot of local stuff. Very, very high quality talent level, a lot of bands that people don't know about. And that's one of the reasons we make it free as well, to expose our people in our neighborhood to music that they would have otherwise never heard before.
We've got our most diverse lineup that we've had in our 3 years. So we've got a wide array of folk, obviously. But it runs the gamut of psychedelic music to indie rock to hip-hop to funk to soul. Really diverse set of music this year, which I actually think, even though we don't have a lot of name artists that people are going to kind of jump off the page at, I think our talent level across the board is the best it's been in the 3 years this year, probably.
Okay. Do you want to recommend a few acts that people must see?
Yeah, there's a lot. The band that's headlining our main stage at the end of the night, we don't really have a technical headliner, I guess, for the festival, but their name's Mother Folk. They're a lot of fun. They played every year of the festival. There's a band from Bloomington I really like called Mind Parade, a psychedelic rock band that I'm excited to see. I've never seen them live. There's a duo that I've discovered called Keller and Cole, and they're actually going to play at Square Cat Vinyl at our shop the day of the festival. So those are a few of mine that kind of stand out, but like I said, across the board is pretty solid.
Looking forward to Charlie Parr coming back down from Duluth. He's amazing. And our buddy Chicago Farmer from Illinois, obviously.
Yeah, one of the things I like about I'm not sure if I found – I think it was on the app – was being able to click on a name and listen to that act and hear what they sound like and mm-hmm. kind of plan out your visit that way.
Our web design girl is the best, most talented design person we've ever met, ever. She did great work with that website. All kinds of people keep commenting on how amazing it is and how the big festival should be using that same format.
Yeah, I would agree. What have the past festivals been like? What was the first one like as far as attendance and music, and how has it progressed?
First year, so we had 70 bands. I think we had 9 stages the first year. So we started pretty big to begin with. That year was great. It was actually way better than I would have ever thought, which is what kind of spurred us to keep going. Last year, we had 100 bands, same as this year, similar amount of stages. We had pretty lousy weather last year, which kind of...
Terrible weather.
Yeah, it kind of put a damper on things. It was like 40-some degrees with wind in May, and so that was a little bit of a downer, but the music was great. The people that came out still really enjoyed themselves. This year's very similar to last year, I think, so we didn't want to go much beyond 100 acts. It's 100 acts in one day is about the limit probably to the amount of acts you want to have in one day without going crazy.
So I was going to ask you, what about the weather? You know, it's something like festivals bring out the worst in Indiana weather. I don't know what that is. So,
it's very true. Yeah, yeah.
This, personally, it has something to do with us, I think. We're cursed as of now. The first year of the Folk Fest was good, but every event we've done after that has been cold and rainy or windy. So,
well, Jazz Fest might give you a run for your money. They got a long history of that, too.
We just accept it now. We'll just move forward and deal with it as it comes.
Yeah. So business-wise, how did you get people to buy into to doing this?
I think it was actually a lot easier the first year than I thought. Just kind of telling people, hey, we're out here to promote you guys in the neighborhood. We don't bring in food trucks. We want people to go check out the businesses in Fountain Square and Fletcher Place. So that was a way to draw in those folks pretty easily. Beyond that, it's been a little bit more of a struggle to try to branch out to businesses maybe that don't know the neighborhood as well. But I think the idea of putting on something free is also enticing to a lot of folks, and they see the value in that. For sure, I think that's part of it.
Yeah. And after the first year, a lot of the businesses had record-setting days, so it's been easy to have everybody else on board because of that.
I was thinking that if people come down there, they don't have to invest in a ticket, then they've got money to spend on food and extras. That is something. What else do you want people to know about the festival?
So I guess beyond just music, we'll have a lot of art vendors that will be set up. This year we have about 3 city blocks that we're going to shut down in Fountain Square. We also have stages in Fletcher Place as well on Virginia Avenue, but there'll be a 3-block stretch where we'll have art vendors. A lot of our stages are located in that stretch. Beer and wine sales in that stretch as well. We have a VIP package available where people can buy a ticket for $35. They get special acoustic sets from some of the featured artists at the festival. They get free food from Pure Eatery and Gomez Barbecue. They also get some drinks from Dogfish Head, who's our presenting sponsor for the festival. I encourage anybody that hasn't been to come on out. It really is an all-day party. It's just a fun time.
Yeah, that's how I figured out that the tickets were free when I got to the VIP thing and said, oh, you can buy a VIP or you can go for free. But the VIP thing, it's $35, right?
Yeah.
And that's not an excessive amount for a full day of entertainment.
Sure, so. Yeah.
The Virginia Avenue Folk Festival is Saturday, May 13th. For more information, visit virginiaavenuefolkfest.com. The Indiana Transportation Museum shelters a remarkable rolling home commissioned for Henry Morrison Flagler. This isn't just any Gilded Age mansion, though. It's a spectacular wooden train car with a lounge, 3 bedrooms, a dining room, and a kitchen. It dates to a period of rapid industrialization and the equally rapid wealth that came to people like Henry Flagler, who invested in a little company called Standard Oil. For more than 3 decades, a Central Indiana engineer has cared for the Flagler car, which is now for sale. So I invited Craig Pressler to tell us a little about this specimen described as the best wooden train car extant.
Okay, so we're going to try to do the impossible, which is do justice to this rolling piece of artwork with just our voices. But I want to start with who was Henry Flagler?
Henry was a self-made millionaire, quite an amazing man. He was born in 1830, went to work in a cousin's dry goods store when he was, I think, 14. And they did quite well through the Civil War, selling stuff to the Army. And right after the Civil War, one of his friends, who'd been a grain salesman, was starting a new business and asked Henry for some capital. And Henry became a full partner in what became Standard Oil. His friend, the grain salesman, was John D. Rockefeller. So Henry made an enormous amount of money.
Wow.
And through the next several years, devoted himself to expanding the company. He did things then that would not be appropriate today.
Such as?
If he bought, well, if you had your own small oil company and got an offer from Henry, you were best to take it.
And okay.
The people who did very well by that accepted Standard Oil stock instead of cash and became multimillionaires themselves. But in that way, with a bit of pressure, Standard Oil grew very quickly to the biggest company in the country. And obviously, Rockefeller and Flagler did extremely well. Mm-hmm. You don't hear much of Flagler. His first wife had been quite ill most of the time they were married. And they took frequent trips to the Riviera to lay in the sun and feel better, then come back. And one year they did not feel she could make the trip by ship to France. So they took the train to Florida and stayed at a hotel that was fairly nice. But when they went home, his wife became more ill and she died. And a year or two later, he went back to the same hotel in Florida with his second wife, who'd been the nurse to the first wife.
Aww.
And bought the hotel, remodeled it. This was in St. Augustine. They paved the streets and put in utilities.
And this was before Florida was what?
Absolutely.
If you walk up to somebody in the street and say Florida, they picture it fully developed as it is today. But Florida was an untapped resource at that time.
Very, very primitive at that point. But Henry realized the climate was as nice as it was in the Mediterranean. And to encourage the development, he bought a small railroad and then started extending it, and it ultimately reached all the way south to Key West. And
wow.
Along the way, he built or purchased 13 hotels to encourage the very rich elite from up north to travel down. And in the course, he had the trains painted a bright yellow. And they had trackage rights back to the north. So if you were along the line and saw the bright yellow train flash by, you knew it was the Florida Special.
Huh.
His hotels became very, very, very busy. So it was very nice. And each of the hotels had tracks, like a parking lot, to park private cars for very, very rich people. Most of the public today is familiar with coaches and dining cars and sleeping cars, but not so familiar with private cars. And those were done for very rich people or railroad executives. And in this case, Henry was both. So with the purchase of the first little railroad, he had a nice car. But as he developed hotels and his friends were coming down to visit, their cars became bigger and grander and more beautiful. So the car that's at Noblesville is his second car that was purchased to keep up with his friends.
And it's sunshine, it's Florida sunshine yellow on the outside, but inside, I've had the delightful experience of riding on a short stretch of track in the Flagler car. It is like a Victorian mansion inside.
That was exactly the intent. It's the Learjet of the day. He also had yachts, of course. But the very intent of this is to have a nice way to travel without being bothered by the public. So the end doors on the car can be locked from the inside so you won't be bothered by the common people coming back wandering around into your private car. but it is fully equipped for all that you need, with a lounge at the rear, a master bedroom, a guest bedroom, a bathroom with a shower, a full dining room, a pantry for the dishes, then a full kitchen, and a bedroom for two servants.
Wow.
So it,
everything you needed in the and the option of going someplace warmer in the winter.
Very much. And in this case, because he could, he asked the car company to provide a car on a blank check. And the orders were, do the best you can. So this car is literally the best that money can buy from 1898. And the interior is unusual because most cars were very dark oak or cherry, and he wanted a car sunny like Florida. So the interior paneling is canarium, which is a blonde mahogany from tropical climate around the Canary Islands off Africa.
Sounds expensive, especially back then.
Quite. And the paneling is satinwood, which is a heavy tropical hardwood that is so full of resin, when you look into it and move, it appears to be like a hologram shifting in color and tone, because you're actually looking into the wood grain due to the amount of resin in the wood. Tropical hardwoods have a lot of resin to resist insects, but in this case, it makes it extra beautiful. But it's very unusual on the interior of a car. So it's much, much lighter and brighter inside than most. And we're told the stained glass in the trim along the ceiling and the silver service were done by one of Henry's neighbors in New York City, who was Louis Tiffany.
Oh, my goodness.
So that the glass along there has seashells and dolphins to indicate Florida.
Craig Pressler's cared for the Flagler car for more than three decades. The car is for sale, but even if you aren't in the market, check it out at OzarkMountainRailCar.com. OzarkMountainRailCar.com. Every week, a Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long talks five songs with someone from our community. Here's this week's journey.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto. I'm joined today by percussionist Corey Denham. Corey, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Corey, you're a member of Forward Motion, a new music or classical indie ensemble. And Forward Motion is performing May 12th. And remind me where that concert is happening.
At Indie Convergence.
Okay. And give us a few words about Forward Motion. What kind of music are you guys playing?
So Forward Motion is a new music ensemble. And what that means to us is that we play newly composed classical music. So not just playing classical music from the past, but playing music composed by living composers, which is our main intent as artists with the group.
And Corey, I put you on the spot here to come up with five songs to share with our listeners, and you scrambled to meet my request, so I appreciate that. What's your first song?
My first selection is from the Jonathan Scales Forkestra, and the title is TNFJ. Jonathan Scales is a hometown hero where I come from in Asheville, North Carolina. He's a steel pan artist with a backing band, and TNFJ stands for Tuesday Night Funk Jam, which I was a regular attendee. And it just has a special place in my heart, just because it was a great funk jam, and this song really reflects the spirit of that jam session. So my second selection comes from Colin Stetson and Sarah Neufeld, who are a saxophonist and violinist, respectively. And that is The Sun's Roar Into View. Colin Stetson is a saxophonist who plays bass saxophone with a series of electronics, and it's a completely amazing sound that is unlike anything I've ever heard. Thank you. Number three is from a group called So Percussion, and it's a piece by composer Bryce Desner, who's also the lead singer for the band The National. And the piece is called Music for Wood and Strings, and as a percussionist, this piece really speaks to me because it's very inventive. Bryce Desner invented an entirely new instrument for this piece, and you'll hear what he calls chord sticks, which are instruments that are basically two guitar necks connected together, played on by percussionists with pencils and drumsticks. It's very, very great sound. Four, I'm going to go with Good Lava off the new Esperanza Spalding album. She is a huge musical inspiration for me and is so multi-talented in so many ways as a singer and bassist and songwriter. And I think this song off this new album really reflects a very cool evolution in her sound and her music.
Fifth and final song, Corey Denham.
I am going to go back to, as I'm a percussionist, I'm going to go back to So Percussion, and I'm going to talk about the Drum Kit Quartet by Glenn Cochee. Glenn Cochee is the drummer for the band Wilco, and he collaborated with So Percussion to compose these drum kit quartets for the group.
Corey, as I mentioned, you're a member of the new music ensemble Forward Motion. Where can folks keep up with all your music-making activities online?
You can find us on Facebook, just at Forward Motion, very easy to find.
And thanks for sharing such an interesting mix of music with us. I really appreciate it, Corey.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today's contributors included Mark Allen, Jill Dittmeyer, and Lou Harry. Hear The Art of the Matter Saturday mornings at 7 or join us Thursday nights at 8. And remember, you can always listen to and share our podcast at WFYI.org. Next week, painters Justin Vining and Benny Sanders egg each other on, and Bigfoot Yancey pays a visit. And of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call What'll We Do? All of that and so much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, producer Melissa Davis, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.